You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, October 14th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are streaming live steps from the industrially brought. It's Friday.
Ravaged.
Yeah. On the program today, the great Cliff Schechter to look back on this crazy week. We've heard from Cliff quite a bit. Well, we heard from him on Monday. Also on the program today, ostensibly to give us a movie recommendation for the weekend, the great Isabel Gillies will join us. And a brief call-in from one of the screaming majority, the creators of Waste, Fraud, and Abuse, now playing well off-Broadway. On the program today, Donald Trump continues to explode, ladies and gentlemen, and then reconstitute to explode again, and reconstitute to explode again. We'll look at the down ballot races. Clinton expanding her lead, but it's not yet helping in terms of the Senate. More WikiLeaks emails. The White House warns Donald Trump, don't mess with Michelle Obama.
Subliminal Elizabeth, messaging.
Right. I mean, it's literally like what I do with Saul, where I'm like, hey, don't you eat this hamburger on my fork. Right? Oh, darn it. He ate it.
I did it.
Elizabeth Warren calls for Mary Jo White, the SEC chair, to be fired. And good news, the DEA will not ban kratom, which it's a drug which could provide a lot of pain relief for a lot of people. And Chris Christie's days continue to be numbered. And hopefully that number is smaller every day that we move forward. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Today, the way I fooled Saul into getting his pants on to go to school was I kept holding up the pants and dropping them and going, these pants are broken. They don't work. You can't wear these. And he's like, no, they work. And I'm like, no, they don't. And he just did it. And I think that's basically what the White House is doing with Donald Trump. Just don't you attack Michelle Obama.
Love to see the Kellyanne Conway meeting where he's like, well, first of all, she's not even the type of black person that I like. Is there any way that we cannot say that, Mr. Trump? Why?
Why?
Everyone wants to silence me. There's no one I can trust.
She's not a five.
I'm not even going to talk to Ivanka anymore. That's how horrible things are getting. No date nights, and I can't attack Michelle Obama. Screw all of you.
I also noticed that Paul Ryan is now tweeting out Ayn Rand stuff. Like he said, he had a tweet today, something like saying when, or maybe it was yesterday, when Hillary Clinton says we're all in this together, she basically means that we're subject to the state. A total.
I'm going to reach back to middle school sociopathy to distract from the fact that I endorsed a probable rapist.
No word on whether or not the FDA will be still checking food safety between now and that time that Hillary Clinton allows us to be subject to the state. That, I mean, understand, this is a strategy, right? Like, the libertarianism is the last refuge of the conservative. That's where they basically said, well, I'm just going to stand over here and just get more philosophical about things. Because people are really, I mean, that's honestly, that is basically it. And make no mistake about it. Donald Trump, embedded in Donald Trump's success, is Paul Ryan standing on a stage retelling an anecdote as if it was a true story and also butchering it about an African-American kid coming to school and saying, I would rather a brown bag lunch than a free lunch from school because that means that I'm loved and I have dignity.
So the answer is no lunch.
So the answer is, let's just not give him a free lunch, and maybe that'll encourage someone somewhere to give him a brown bag lunch. If not, at least he has his dignity. Understand that the message that is being communicated there is, if you're poor, it is because of a cultural problem. And if you're poor, you have a moral deficiency that can only be fixed by becoming rich, right? If you get a free lunch, you are morally deficient. You don't have any dignity. So the answer is take away the free lunch. Allow this person to go out and get morality or to get a lunch that comes from home, to get some type of wealth that allows them to do whatever it is. In this case, it's just to bring a lunch. So the corollary to that is, of course, that Donald Trump, who is a billionaire, must have so much moral righteousness that whoever stands on stage with him is immediately less than. And that's basically what Paul Ryan has. Well, I don't know that he alone has done this, but that is the conservative ideology. That's why you get a Donald Trump. But I know we'll see. President Obama seems to be trying to tie the Republicans in with Trump, which it's, I think we're about a month and a half too late for that, but who knows? Just a reminder, next week, Monday I'll be here, but then Tuesday I head to Vegas. I will probably be doing Hayes' show at 6 p.m. Eastern time. And then we'll do live coverage of the debate. But you know what that means, folks. I'm going to be shaving sometime between now and then. And when I shave, you know I use my Harry's. Still have somebody who's tweeting out every time I go on Hayes, saying like, thanks, Harry's. Sam looks good. And you know what I love most about Harry's. Yes, it's a great shave. And now they have made the blades a little bit smaller, so more precision in my nostril. But it's basically, it's cheaper. Yes. Michael just texted me. Cheap, cheap, cheap. Well, I'm not cheap. I'm frugal. Ladies and gentlemen.
And by frugal, I mean cheap.
Yes. $2 a blade compared with four or more you pay at the drugstore. Harry's is so confident in the quality of their blades, they'll send you their popular free trial set, which comes with a razor, a five-blade cartridge, and a shaving gel. Free when you sign up for a shave plan. You just pay for the shipping. You get your first one free. How awesome is that? Plus, a special offer for the fans of the show. Enter code MAJORITYREPORT at checkout, and you get a post-shave balm added to your order for free. Not only does it smell pretty good, it's not too smelly, because I don't like things that are too smelly. I think people know that about me. And I'm not saying, like, even if it smells good, I don't want to smell it. I don't know if it was because this is, like, an artifact from, like, quitting smoking years ago, and now my olfactory... Is that olfactory? What is that? What you call it? It's olfactory, right? When your nose? Maybe they've come back, and now it's just too intense for me. But like, whenever anybody, not just I'm not pointing fingers, Kelly. Oh my God. bring out like hand lotion or whatever it is. It, like it's I like it. Something happens. My nasal passages. I freak out. I can't breathe.
Somebody brought something in that smells. And now my eyes are watering and I can't read the Social Security trustee report. Right. God damn it.
Well, look, the point is that the bomb isn't overpowering. And it makes your face feel better after you shave. Go to harrys.com right now. Enter the code MAJORITYREPORT at checkout. Claim your free trial set and post-shave balm. Perhaps my favorite word. I don't know why. That's harrys.com, and the code is Majority Report. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, the great Cliff Schechter. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, our next guest has been with us blessedly. He's been in studio in the past week and a half. We've had him on a Monday in the past week and a half. And obviously, I think from just those two visits alone, you can understand why he was so inspiring that someone had to sit down. And I'm speaking of Jimmy Reefer Cake and pen. And perform this.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. You want any of these services? You know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC.
Yes, Cliff Schechter. Hello, Cliff. How are you?
I am mostly doing well, Sam.
Mostly.
I do have a slight problem, which is now that I've been there in the studio with you, it's very hard for me to sit here and you know, just be on the phone and not be a part of all the coolness that goes on there regularly.
Oh, my God. It's so cool in here.
And I have to live with that, you know?
I know. That's got to be hard. I can only imagine the yearning that it must create. As I sit here and just look at all the coolness. I'm distracted, frankly. You miss this when Matt wears his special T-shirt, the one with the red stripe around the arm that we thought was his stylish look, but it just turns out that his backpack, like, what was it? Your backpack leaked on you?
Yeah, it was a new bag, and the dye leached into. It was raining out, and I forgot my umbrella, and the dye leached into my shirt. And I think it looks good.
Dude, this likely is excuse. I think it's like a Nazi armband. He's going to a Trump rally.
No, it's not quite that. But
it's a cool look.
It's a cool look, but it's a bit of a drop off. When Matt first came in for his interview, he wore like a. I don't know if it was a suit. It was like a 3-piece suit or some type of thing.
You know what Matt told me later? He said, he's like, I knew I needed to look sharp for the Jew.
That's, was that real?
Oh, weird. Snap.
Jesus.
Did he say,
I don't wear armbands and I didn't say that.
International financial elite?
Yeah, exactly. Well, yes, that raises a good point. Let's talk about that for a moment, shall we? So, Well,
the crazy unleashed by this campaign is, I mean, if anybody who ever asks, you know, why the bully pulpit is important of the president and how, you know, having important cultural figures just by the fact that they get lots of television coverage, say things, can change things, can desensitize people, they really are going to need to study this campaign for years. Because the crap that's sort of crawling out of the gutter at this point, and of course, at this moment, we happen to be talking about Trump's speech the other day.
Well, let's play a clip from it because I think this is pretty amazing. He is going full Alex Jones here. Like, I honestly, I saw this and I was like, Alex Jones is sitting somewhere in Austin, Texas, calling his wife into the room and saying, "Holy crap, he said it! I can't believe it." And here it is.
You know, this is a G-rated show, but I think at that moment you'd want to make sure both of Alex Jones' hands were above the table, if you know what I'm saying.
Yes, I understand. Here's Donald Trump. Like, and understand, this is written. Like, this is his campaign saying, we're going this place. They have already made the pivot to Trump TV, if you ask me. But here it is.
And lobbyists. For those who control the levers of power in Washington and for the global special interest, they partner with these people that don't have your good in mind. Our campaign represents a true existential threat like they haven't seen before. This is not simply another four-year election. This is a crossroads in the history of our civilization that will determine whether or not we, the people, reclaim control over our government. The political establishment that is trying to stop us is the same group responsible for our disastrous trade deals, massive illegal immigration, and economic and foreign policies that have bled our country dry. The political establishment has brought about the destruction of our factories and our jobs as they flee to Mexico, China, and other countries all around the world. Our just announced job numbers are anemic. Our gross domestic product, or GDP, is barely above 1% and going down. Workers in the United States are making less than they were almost 20 years ago, and yet they are working harder. But so am I working harder. That I can tell you.
That he can tell you.
It's a global power structure that is responsible for the economic decisions that have robbed our working class, stripped our country of its wealth, and put that money into the pockets of a handful of large corporations and political entities. Just look at what this corrupt establishment has done to our cities like Detroit, Flint, Michigan, and rural towns in Pennsylvania, Ohio, North Carolina, and all across our country. Take a look at what's going on.
Okay, that's not the clip that we thought it was. I mean, obviously, I mean, he's conflating, you know, the gap in productivity and wages with some type of global, you know, controlling body. But earlier he had said that Hillary Clinton was now meeting with an international cabal to...
He's worked Carlos Slim into this.
Yes.
I mean, it's like Carlos Slim owned it, you know, gave to the Clinton Foundation. Although what's pretty funny is that it's sort of James Murdoch, but we'll look past that. You know, Carlos Slim gave to the Clinton Foundation, so he must be in on it. I mean, he is now, you know, he's playing to all the worst. I mean, he's had a greatest hits for a while, right? I mean, America First, classic Charles Lindbergh back in the day, mm-hmm. who was a big Hitler supporter. The stabbed in the back myth, he's been saying, he's been kind of repeating that for a while, that the weakness of Obama and whatever has screwed our country, and you know, it's allowed ISIS to grow and whatever. He's definitely done some of Hitler's greatest hits, but he hasn't gone full on Hitler until this speech. I mean, this speech is like, I looked up and then I tweeted out like I think it was 1938 speech by Hitler, all about the international bankers. I mean, you know, you basically could have taken the German and translated it into English and you get Donald Trump's speech here. So what's amazing to me, and I guess it shouldn't be, if you know history, that you know there always were even Jews in you know, Germany and Eastern Europe willing to sell out other Jews for their own whatever reasons, all, you know, as there always are members of groups that are willing to sell out their own group. But there is Jared Kushner, right? And his daughter, Ivanka, who's converted to Judaism, and they're raising their kids Jewish. And how they, who are raising their, I mean, granted, maybe, you know, in their palace life and their towers, they, you know, they never have to come across the regular people. But their kids, I assume, go to school somewhere, or will go to school somewhere, you know, his grandkids. And so it's amazing to me how they can enable this. And they know what they're doing. You know what I mean? It's incredible. So
I wonder about that. I think their attitude is just like, well, we're running a business, and right. You know, we don't necessarily agree. Like, you know, I may sell these ties, but I would never buy them. And
well, that's a great point, right? Like how he attacks all the stuff in China, but then he buys Chinese steel that's dumped, and he has his ties made there. Like, it's all just bullshit. And I guess that's the way his family looks at all this stuff, too. You're right. It's all just business. And if some people get hurt along the way, if a temple gets firebombed or something, it's not going to affect our kids because we're separate from most people. But there are points in life where his grandkids and Ivanka's kids actually will have to come to contact with other people.
Yeah, I think, you know, if they are doing this to set up Trump TV, it's pretty despicable because it's not just like a one-off. Well, we'll get into office and, we'll make good. You know, we're not doing it. The means aren't necessarily the nicest. But it looks like it's going to be a business model. It's just sort of.
Yeah, well, who sent something out? It was interesting. I'm trying to think who it was. I think it was Steve Schmidt, actually, who basically was saying that they're, you know, they'll keep doing this, and then he and Bannon and Isles will break off a 30% chunk away from the Republican Party that'll be like a UKIP type thing, you know, form their own party, and you know, whether they're successful electorally or not, they don't really give a crap, right? Because they'll monetize it by having all the emails, selling them all this crap like they already do, and of course, creating
have you seen the TV station? Have you seen the Trump black card? You know, I'm on the Trump mailing list, and they're offering the black card now. You can
what is that?
It is like that. You for $49, you get like a Trump credit card that you can't use to buy anything. It's just, and it's black.
So it's like a fake credit card that's black.
Yeah, it's really just unbelievable. And
so
maybe,
they're just going to sell all sorts of crap. So through their email list and other ways, but they'll also create, I'm sure, a TV station.
Yeah.
And so if they can grab that 30% chunk, it may be more than that, of the Republican Party, that are all these losers and these nuts, then they can monetize that for billions. I mean, frankly, you know, it is funny because the thing about Trump is, and all these guys have this in common, right? I mean, it used to be that Republicans, I mean, true, Richard Nixon was kind of one of those working class whites, so he kind of knew how they thought. But there are a lot of other Republicans who came along, let's call them Bushes, for example, patrician types, who played up all those themes because they knew that's how they could win votes, and they could win disenchanted whites by playing sort of subtle and often not so subtle Willie Horton-esque racism and sexism. But you now have, if you look at all these guys, they are like the crew around Trump is no different than the crew that's in the crowd screaming for him. Mm-hmm. They are one and the same. You've got your, you know, your middle to working class background of someone like Chris Christie, Rudy Giuliani from Brooklyn. You know, Donald Trump grows up in Queens and always looks over the bridge and wishes he could live in Manhattan and be one of the elite people. You know, you've got Roger Iles, who grew up in Warren, Ohio, very working class neighborhood. Like, they all have the same sort of paranoid, angry, resentful mentality. So they are of the people they're actually creating. And the irony is that Trump always wanted to escape that. He always wanted to be one of the glitterati, right? He created these hotels and these golf courses and everything for the rich, for the elite, so he could be one of them. And he never really felt accepted by them. But now the supreme irony of all this, I don't know if you saw, there was a report on how, was it that's in Washington this week? Is it like an IMF conference or there's some huge conference in D.C.? And every single five-star hotel is full to the rim, right? His hotel, the Trump hotel that he just opened, the one that he did his little thing at the, from the old post office there, is half empty. And the other ones are averaging rooms costing $1,100 a night. And he had, you know, just obviously it's still expensive, but this is a five-star top-notch hotel, as it's supposed to be, have fallen in some cases to like $395 a night, $400 a night. They're going for a third, essentially, of what the other rooms are, and the place is half empty because there's such a stigma attached. He has destroyed his brand among the very group of people that he wanted to be among. So, no, he's going to have no trouble making a ton of money off of all these imbecilic rubes. You know, there's no doubt about that. It's not like he's going to be in financial trouble. But the very group of people he always wanted to be one of, that he was lusting after to be considered an accepted member of the elite in Manhattan, he's basically now made his name. He's got a black mark next to his name now because of that. And people don't want to stay at his hotels. I mean, they were asking people, literally interviewing people who came in for this conference, and they were like, absolutely not. I was not only, you know, some of them were like, I would never stay at a Trump property, but other ones were like, I couldn't stay there and then tell other people I was staying there. That's what he's done.
Right.
His brand.
That's healthy, I think. That's a healthy thing for the country.
Well, it's good for all of us. It's just amazingly ironic if you think about what this guy always wanted in life, and he's accomplished just the opposite of that now.
Yeah, except for the fact that he also has become the Republican nominee and has put himself into history in a way that I think, or at least, you know, he can convince himself he has. And I think probably he has.
Well, he has put himself in history and he can convince himself of anything. I mean, look, but, you know, when we tend to not say positive things about right wing and left wing, even demagogues who hurt people. I mean, it's positive history, you know, it may fit into Trump's theory of, as long as I'm being written about, it's good.
Yeah.
But he's going to be written about like tyrants are written about.
All right.
You know, and we don't know the half of it yet, because sadly, there are going to probably be innocent people. I mean, you hear about kids getting beaten up in school. There was a Muslim kid who was 11 years old or something, got beaten up in his school the other day as the kids were yelling Trump. I just saw it quickly. I, you know, but this stuff easily, he's trying to make this stuff escalate. It could escalate. And, you know, people can get killed, and he will be remembered for that. I guess to him, it doesn't matter. Anything's good. But I mean, I guess whatever. I'm overdoing this. The point is, it's ironic when you consider how he grew up wanting to be among the elite in Manhattan, and he's sort of caused himself to go in the opposite direction.
So, yeah, I mean, to your point, I saw I think it was in Arizona, maybe a guy who came out just started yelling at some construction workers, calling them illegals and demanding to see their papers because there was a beeping noise coming from their truck. And the news people went back to this guy's house, and he was a legal resident. Just, you know, a guy was taking care of his family. All right, but we have that clip of this is where Trump really goes off the rails and is now basically full-on Alex Jonesing it. And I don't know, this is it's fascinating to me. Like, you know, you got to think, what is the value of saying something like this? Like, when they sit down to write this speech, what is the value of saying something like this in the context of a national political campaign? Play this clip.
It's a global power structure that is responsible for the economic decisions that have robbed our working class, stripped our country of its wealth, and put that money into the pockets of a handful of large corporations and political entities. Just look at what this corrupt establishment has done to our cities like Detroit, Flint, Michigan, and rural towns in Pennsylvania, Ohio, North Carolina, and all across our country. Take a look at what's going on. They've stripped away these towns bare and raided the wealth for themselves and taken our jobs away out of our country, never to return unless I'm elected president. The Clinton machine is at the center of this power structure. We've seen this firsthand in the WikiLeaks documents in which Hillary Clinton meets in secret with international banks to plot the destruction of U.S. sovereignty in order to enrich these global financial powers, her special interest friends, and her donors. So true.
What are you talking about?
Look at him. He's just now, they're cheering Locker up, and he's just sort of prowling around on the stage.
Honestly, she should be locked up. Should be.
There you have it. I mean, the meeting with the international bankers. If that sounds familiar, it's because it crops up every now and then.
What's a strange assortment of people. It's a very strange conspiracy that I think involves international bankers, Miss Universe contestants, and irate spider monkeys.
Right.
And
well, I mean,
they all get together.
But I mean, this is. I mean, the point is, what is the political calculation here? I mean, is there one? Who is this appealing to? Like, who hasn't signed up? If there, I know there's a lot of people who believe this type of stuff and who respond to these type of theories. And that's how Alex Jones, you know, makes his living. But
right.
are these people not signed up? Are these people not signed up to vote for Trump at this point? Like, I mean,
well, you know, there's these theories on the right, as there are many theories on the right. Which is, you know, that there's this huge pool of white voters, you know, that the white male voters that haven't voted, and that this kind of stuff can get them to turn out. A lot of people looked at that statistically and broke it down, and I don't remember anymore.
Sean Trend, I think it was, at Real Clear Politics, is convinced there's like something
That's
like
right.
4 million, 5 million extra white male votes out there.
Who looked at this and then looked at the fact that there are some, but the largest proportion of them are in states that don't matter anyhow, that one side or the other side is going to win. And so basically what they found, you know, and I'm trying to remember if it was the New York Times upshot that looked at this, that like maybe possibly get them close to winning in like one or two states. I think it was like Iowa and Nevada or something like that, if you looked at it and you did it. But in the end, what would it cost him? Which is huge swaths of college-educated voters, particularly women and others. Either they're in their own bubble believing that this is actually – there are these voters out there that don't exist, which is possible because Trump believes all sorts of crap, as we know, that isn't true. Or alternatively, they don't care anymore. And it really is about getting, like, literally creating and this is what it is, so let's call it what it is, a neo-fascist movement like UKIP, you know, the party in England, that can basically rally, you know, 20%, 15%, whatever the hell it ends up being of the overall population, and they can monetize that and make billions of dollars. Because, again, that's all you need. I mean, that's much more. People forget that Bill O'Reilly gets 3 to 4 million viewers every night, and he makes 30 million or whatever the hell he makes a year. I mean, you don't, you know, when you're talking about, not talking about winning election, when you're just talking about filling your airwaves, you know,
right,
and that kind of thing, I mean, this is gold for them. So if that's what you want, and maybe they believe both those things at the same time, that these missing voters will help them win and they're going to monetize it afterwards. They're wrong about the first part. Sadly, they're right about the second part.
All right. Well, let's pivot to talk about the down ballot races at this point, because the big story coming out of that's going around right now is coming out of 538, where Harry Enten says that we're not seeing yet, and this is the big operative word, I think, we're not seeing yet any impact on the Senate races in terms of Clinton's lead. It's not, you know, so Clinton is surging, but down ballot races.
And I find that weird, Sam, because, again, I defer. These guys, you know, I'm a statistical child compared to them. I'm not, you know, I don't try to argue with people like Nate Cohn and Harvey, was it Harry Enten?
Right.
But the thing is that, you know, just a month ago when Hillary was closer, to pick two races, for example, Pennsylvania and New Hampshire, you know, we were both at a disadvantage. We're now at an advantage. It may not be a huge one, but I think they've got McGinty and in fact, I looked like an hour or two ago, so I know this. They've got McGinty and they've got Hassan. Both are over 50%, somewhere in the 55% winning range, 45%
right.
losing. Well, you'd like them to be a lot higher than that, but a few weeks ago, they were both at like the 40% winning range.
Right.
So I don't understand how you can say that Hillary is moving up. You know, it may not. I guess the important term would be, well, two, as you said, yet. It's not because some of those times those races lag behind, and Democrats are now making those arguments in ads and other places, tying the rest of the field to Trump. And as our discussion was a few weeks ago, when we talked about the various problems with not tying the rest of the Republicans to Trump, you know, they've now changed. Hillary Clinton is doing it, and most notably Barack Obama in the speech he gave in Cleveland today, and other places, is very distinctly doing it. And he's got a pretty big mic in front of him. And so there's going to be a lot of that going on at the top and down ballot with a lot of the money they have left. And right now, because Hillary's people are confident, Trump just pulled out of Virginia, for example, they're going to start reallocating some of the money. They're saying at least, I think, the super PAC, if not them, to some of the down ballot races where they'll be able to do this. So it's okay. So some of it's yet. But I would also argue that part of it's also, you know, you haven't maybe fully seen it in polls, but it's clear it's happened. Maybe not enough. Maybe we'd like to have it more. But every point she gains or a few points she gains in Missouri, where, you know, Jason Kander is running a phenomenal race.
Yep.
If she can get, you know, if she can do what she's doing right now, where a poll showed she's down 5, he's winning. I mean, that was the other thing, right? Either he's winning or he's barely losing in the 538. I mean, he's right there. He can win this thing. So, you know, every point makes a difference. You know, everything, she doesn't need to win Missouri because he's running ahead of the top of the ticket by a good 5 to 10 points. So if she can just get within a couple points, I think he wins.
There definitely seems to be. I mean, I think, you know, as a general rule of thumb, you know, it feels like, you know, all things being equal, and obviously in a place like Missouri, it's different, but she's beating what the sort of the typical Democratic presidential ticket would do. If, you know, there's a 5-point lag between, it seems, for the most part, in these between. So, in other words, if Clinton wins by 5 or 6, and you're talking
right.
about something, you know, a Senate race where the Democrat is down by 1, let's say 1 percentage point right now, and if she gets up to like a 5 or 6 or 7% margin in that state, it is that's the type of situation where you see all of these races that are right on the precipice go towards the Democrat, it seems to me.
That's right.
And
then there are states, you know, where she has a turnout operation. And that becomes a question, right? So a classic example is her turnout operation is in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And that race has gotten closer. Hell, the race in Ohio has gotten closer, the Senate race. Portman is still definitely in command.
Read a piece about Portman. Excuse me for one second. I read a piece about Portman where it said that for the past 2 or 3 years, if not more, he's been working on a parallel operation so that he wouldn't have to rely on the Republican Party.
That's right.
To get his voters out. And that's going to hurt. And there's a flip here because he's going to bring out Democrats, I think, or those Republicans.
There are a lot of Portman. There's a lot of country club Republican types that have become Clinton Portman voters. And he
yes.
doesn't care. He's not going to do the analysis on whether the people he's turning out are voting for Trump or Clinton. He doesn't care.
And that's going to hurt
yes.
Trump, but help important.
Yeah, I mean, look, I give him credit as much as I can't stand his policies. He realized that Trump had a great chance before a lot of the rest of them did, and he realized he didn't want to leave his fate in somebody else's hands. He raised an ungodly sum of money, and that.
It's not just Trump. He would have the same problem with Cruz too, I think. Right? I mean, with Trump or Cruz, I think he was smart.
I think he saw that it could be either of them, and then there are others too, right? I mean, what, you know, in 08, Huckabee came in second. What if he'd gotten the nomination? Mm-hmm. Like, people that don't line up with Portman on stuff. And so he did what he needed to do. I'm just saying, so it may be that because he's done that, I mean, look, even though he's done it for a while, he's done it with $14 million. Some of that money's been spent on TV and other types of things. So, you know, it may be a $5 million operation and maybe less. It's not a presidential level operation, I guess is what I'm saying. He doesn't have what Hillary Clinton has, but he does have something to counter, and that's going to make it harder for that effect to be felt here. But think about places like North Carolina and Arizona. Now, right now, Kirkpatrick isn't close enough. But, you know, if McCain and Trump have a all-out battle at the end here or some other things happen, maybe Kirkpatrick can win because they gain 4 points or more based upon the fact that there's no conservative, you know, there's no Republican turnout operation. I'd say that it's the most likely place for this to happen where somebody goes in slightly behind in the polls and wins is North Carolina, because Burr has been lazy as hell and barely campaigned and hasn't done a lot of TV. And most polls are showing that thing to be just about even. Maybe the Democrat Ross is down by a point or so. And, you know, you come in down a point and Hillary's got a real operation turning people out in North Carolina and the Republicans don't, I'd say that can be done. That makes me worry a little more about Kander, for example, because she hasn't targeted Missouri. You know what I mean? So I don't know what kind of a turnout operation I'm sure she's got some field people on the ground there, but I'm sure it's nothing like targeted battleground states. But who knows? Maybe they'll try to get something up and running. I mean, it's pretty late if they have the money and they feel like this is going to be a blowout, because you obviously want every Senate seat you can possibly bring in.
More flexibility. I mean, I think we're, I also look at a place like Nevada,
yep.
And I know we have Nevadans who are writing in saying, like, why are you doing that? Why do you keep doing that? And I'm like, well, I grew up in Worcester, and so get over it. That is a state where we see this dynamic where the resentment of the Republican Party for what they're doing to Trump is, I think, going to hurt a guy like Joe Heck, right? I mean, he's going to have real problems. And you sort of couple that with Harry Reid's machine, which seems to always beat expectations there. I think Nevada
machine there for years. I think that's important, and I hadn't brought that up, and that's a really important point to bring up too, Sam, which is two polls have come out that have shown pretty interesting results. One, I think, was the Reuters poll that gave Democrats a 10-point advantage on the generic ballot. And the other one was one that Global Strategy Group did, and they found that even though you started off with a 7-point lead on the generic ballot, Democrats did, but then they presented people with either or options, which is that the person was either supporting Trump or not supporting Trump. And if they were supporting Trump, they lost all sorts of lean Republican, you know, sort of center right swing voters and people like that, your Portman voters, for example. And if they were, in the other direction, they lost Trump voters who were like, screw them. And they actually interviewed some McCain voters, and, you know, there's an article on this, who said, you know, or not McCain voters, Trump voters in Arizona, who were so pissed at McCain for disavowing him that they now decide they were going to vote for Kirkpatrick just to screw him. Mm. You can't, you know, look, do I know? That's anecdotal. Do I know that's going to happen in large numbers? I have no idea. What I do know is they found in either of those cases, the generic ballot went up to 12-point advantage. Now, if that 10-point to 12-point thing is accurate, in 2006, I believe it was, the Democrats had a 13-point advantage on all those seats. In 2008, when Obama came in and they won a number of seats, they had a 12-point generic advantage, if I remember correctly. So the 10 to 12-point.
But they had that, and to be fair, though, they had that now. So they had that. Those are the numbers, you know, in early October. And
That could change. I'm just talking about what's possible. Look, anything can change week to week. Although I will say some of that is important now because people are voting in a lot of states now.
Yeah.
Now, not at the same clip they will later, but early voting just started here. It's been going on in North Carolina. It's been going on in Florida. It's been going on in a lot of important states. So already North Carolina has shown a huge drop in Republican requests. They can, I think they can request absentee ballots there early. Florida showed that the percentage usually that the Republicans who are older there tend to vote, get a big lead in the beginning, and then Democrats show up more in person when their early voting starts there in person. And so far, the ballots requested have been lower, have been more for Republicans than Democrats, but not by the same margin, a lower margin than in the past. So, you know, these things are all important. So you're right. Anything can change. But what's cool with what's going on right now is it's actually locking in some votes.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what happens. And, of course, you know, I think we still are, you know, a tape or two away. I mean, it's hard to know at this point, like, what would be the thing that would, you know, sort of force the rescindment of the rescindments? Because we've seen this now, right? We've seen there's a couple of Republicans who
right.
have rescinded their rescindments. Do we have sound on that?
Yeah, they go back
that?
And forth. We unendorsed. I mean, I think Burr's done that in North Carolina. I mean, what's her name? Fisher out in Nebraska.
Right.
I think we have
audio of Fisher. Listen to this. This is pretty funny because Deb Fisher, who is a senator from Nebraska, she is on the list of Rush Limbaugh's, turncoat Republicans.
Is she up for reelection, though? I don't even
know.
No,
she's not. And it's not going to impact her, but it's, I think, indicative of just broadly speaking, you know, a sense that there's such ambivalence in the Republican Party that another tape like the one we saw the last week, if something
well,
like that
drops. Well, they're reporting another woman's coming forward today. So we'll see if that's, and here's the other thing before you play that tape. Because we give you this extra analysis on the Majority Report. Am I right, Sam?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
We take it to the next level. So here's the next level, which is Deb Fisher may not be up for reelection, but there is an electoral vote in Nebraska that's winnable. It's the kind of suburban district because Nebraska and Maine both give you the two electoral votes for winning the state, and then each congressional district gives you one for there. And the district around, which is a swing area around Omaha and its suburbs, right now, Obama is barely winning there and would win it, theoretically, according to Nate Silver, if it happened today. So if you're Deb Fisher out there re-endorsing Trump and you've got the kind of suburban swing voters in Omaha who get pissed off at people supporting Trump, they could just get ticked at the whole party and even if they weren't going to turn out, say, you know what, I'm going to turn out just to vote against Donald Trump and vote for Hillary Clinton, and that could cost them an electoral vote.
Yes, but I think the real key to what Deb Fisher shows is that this is a dynamic that's playing out. So with someone like Deb Fisher, who's not up for re-election now, who's in a state that would be more inclined to be, you know, more pro-Trump, just broadly speaking, she rescinds her rescindment. For a guy like John McCain, it is still just like too hard to sort of calculate, right? Like he doesn't know.
Right.
Are there
and that all? It's McCain. It's Ayotte. I would never know how to pronounce her damn name. It's Rob Portman here. They all rescinded. So you know they could all lose. There could be Trump voters in all three of these states. Toomey has just avoided it. So I don't know how that affects him. Maybe he pisses off everybody. And Blunt has stuck with
Joe Heck.
Trump, and maybe, you know, he loses suburban voters in Kansas City, and you know, so it's hard to tell. Yeah,
it's very difficult. But here is, do we have that sound of Deb Fisher? Here's that sound of Senator Deb Fisher sort of backing up and when she, you know, you call into the radio station and you just sort of like finesse your position. Here it is.
Senator Fisher, we had breaking news here on Drive Time Lincoln last night. Governor Ricketts joined us, and he talked about the fact that he is still backing Donald Trump for President of the United States. In fact, he went as far as to say he is voting for Trump. Would you tell our listeners about your decision and where you're at with your decision?
Well, like most Nebraskans, I am fully committed to defeating Hillary Clinton. I support the Republican ticket, and I plan to vote for Mr. Trump and Mr. Pence on November 8th. You know, I put out a statement on Friday, and it was with regard to Mr. Trump's comments. I felt they were disgusting. I felt they were unacceptable. And but I never said I was not voting for our Republican ticket. So I would just say to you to look at that statement. We all know there's a lot at stake, from the Supreme Court to our conservative positions that we take on a number of issues, whether it's immigration or taxes or our Second Amendment rights or with regards to regulations. And we need to make sure that we support the Republican ticket. And I've said that from the beginning here, and I continue to support the Republican ticket.
Senator,
I did say, Mr. Trump, you know, it would be wise for him to step aside and allow Mike Pence to serve as our party's nominee. And he decided he was not stepping aside. I respect his decision, and I support the Republican ticket, and that's a Trump-Pence ticket.
And that's what I wanted to ask you about, because you did.
We don't need it. That's the profile and courage there. I love the – it is totally unacceptable, but if I have to, I can accept it.
Well, yeah, it reminds me of all those guys earlier who were like, he's a con man, and he's a danger to the country, and I don't want the nuclear codes in his hands, and whatever. Like, are you supporting him? Well, yeah, he's the Republican. I don't want Hillary Clinton to win, for Christ's sake. I mean, it was just, they're all hilarious, man.
Hilarious.
The party just needs to be flushed down the drain.
All right, well, Cliff.
Which it may be.
It very well may be. So, Cliff, next time I see you, it will be in person in Las Vegas next week. Is that right?
Are we going to party?
At the very least, we're going to talk about the final presidential debate.
Well, I meant party like a couple 40 somethings, which means like we play a round of blackjack. I drink one drink and then I fall asleep at 8:30.
Well, I'll go in. I've got a whole array of movies I can watch alone without my family in my room. Yeah,
I hope those aren't of a pornographic variety.
Well, I mean, look,
there's people that might get that. You know, there's some Republicans who've declared that a health risk in their platform before nominating Donald Trump.
I wouldn't want to do anything unhealthy. Not in Vegas.
Yeah, don't do that. Make sure if you're going to get some porn that Trump is not one of those movies Trump shows up in.
Would scar me for life, I think. All right. Cliff Schechter, always a pleasure. See you next week, buddy.
All right. Thanks a lot, Sam. Thanks, guys. Take care.
All right, folks, run a little behind, but that's okay. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to one of the guys who have created Waste, Fraud, and Abuse. We'll be right back. I loved your house when you were sleeping. All right, we're back. And ladies and gentlemen, longtime listeners will recall that, and I don't even know when this was, like 3 years ago now?
God. I think it was 1,000 years.
1,000 years ago, ladies and gentlemen.
It was a long time.
I don't know if you guys were the first guys to do this, or you and Jimmy Reefercake and some other people, but.
I think Jimmy Reefercake was first.
Jimmy Reefercake was first, and then. Suddenly, the Screaming Majority. Now, was that the name? We have one of the members of Screaming Majority, Dan Killian. That wasn't a pre-existing band, was it?
No. That was a tribute to you, and we've held on to the name. You could probably sue us.
Well, all right. I'll contemplate doing that. We'll see how much. We'll see how well your production does, and how deep your pockets are. So you guys now. So you and Dave create. Was it you two guys who did this? Dave Benjoya.
This was the two of us.
Okay.
Yeah.
So tell us about it.
It's a rich couple. Gets a divorce.
But wait, no. Even before you tell us the story, tell us what, did you guys decide, like, we need to sit down and create a musical or what? Well, how did this happen?
Absolutely. It was because of you.
Well,
I'm talking twice, like Donald Trump.
I musically inspired you.
Believe me. We were doing it every week for you, and, like, the topics would come and go, and we're like, let's do something that lasts. You know, a little longer, you know, that we can sit down and waste a lot of time and money on. And we came up with this, a musical.
Waste, Fraud, and Abuse. And where is it playing?
It's at the 13th Street Rep in Manhattan. It's a historic theater between 5th and 6th Avenues. And it's a lovely place, and it's a lovely thing.
And where can people get more information? What's the website?
Waste, Fraud, and Abuse, themusical.com.
All right. So tell us about the story. What is this about?
Rich people, divorce, feud, political elections. They got the money to do it, so they fight through politics, and our country is held in the sway.
And this isn't something that you guys, I mean, you guys have been working on this. Didn't you put up the production in 2015 as well?
We did do a one-off at the Judson Memorial Church Theater, and it was great. And we loved it so much, we said, let's do a three weekend run. So we're in the second weekend here at the 13th Street Rep. And
how's attendance been?
It's been a lot of fun.
How's attendance been? Fantastic. Amazing.
Fantastic.
The most amazing attendance.
It's been pretty good. You're probably going to close us out right here.
This is something you got to see. I'm going to try and make it. I've got to go to Vegas. I'm not around this weekend. I'm going to try and make it when I get back. I've been looking forward to this, and it's sort of crept up on me again. You guys did it right before the election. I know that's probably good timing from your perspective.
But. That was the idea, yeah. It was to hit them when they're sick of it.
How many people?
It isn't.
How big of a production is it? Like, how many people are in it?
Oh, we've got a cast of 17 and a live band on stage, the Screaming Majority Band.
Oh, this is exciting.
We await your lawsuits. And it's a big deal.
All right. Well, so
For me, it's a lot of been a lot of work, but we're pretty pleased with it.
Are you going to shoot any of it? I mean, are we going to be able to see like any of it on YouTube or something like that after the fact?
You'll see some YouTubes. As long as we're happy with the quality of the footage, we will stick some stuff up on YouTube, and we will be making an original cast recording. That's how Americans get their musicals these days, is through the original cast recordings. Most people can't afford to see an actual show, but they can see Waste, Fraud, and Abuse because it's $18.
Wow, folks, a musical that is of the time, timely musical.
It's affordable, of the time. It might get sold out, so we could be in Hamilton territory. Dave, my collaborator, was saying it's the opposite of Hamilton in that it's an old school musical about someone who destroys the country.
There you go. Well, and Hamilton's a little bit more right leaning in some respects too.
I can't afford to see it, so in that regard, it's priced out of my range.
Well, no, I'm not saying the production. I don't know about the production himself, but Hamilton himself as a. As a dude, a little bit right-leaning. I mean, you know, just a little bit right-leaning. Not so excited about having everybody participate in democracy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, sometimes democracy has its problems, too.
Well,
we've seen some. But, you know, it all hopefully will come out in the wash. Is that the expression I'm looking for?
From your mouth. From your mouth to God's ears. All right. Well, Daniel Killian, the musical is Waste, Fraud, and Abuse. You can check it out. We have a link at majority.fm. Go buy some tickets, folks. Check it out. You're gonna love it. I've listened to a couple of the tracks, and it's awesome. Thanks so much for joining us, Dan.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate it. You have a lovely rest of your show, and we hope to see you next weekend.
All right, great. All right, folks.
Have fun in Vegas.
I will. Thank you. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Do we have a Jimmy Reef Cake song?
Yeah.
We do have a Jimmy Reef Cake song, and I am going to, of course, we will play the song, and I will call Isabel Gillies on the telephone, and we will talk to her in just a moment. What is the name of the Jimmy Reef Cake song?
I'll Vote for Hillary.
What? Oh, this is a deal, isn't it? He's making a deal with me.
Deal or no deal, man.
All right, well, let's hear it.
Heard it from a friend who heard it from a friend who heard Hillary's been messing around. They heard her talking to her rich friends where all her credibility ends, and she's bringing the whole country down. I don't want Trump to win, but Hillary isn't convincing when she talks about Syria being a no-fly. So I'm telling you, babe, that I don't think it's true, babe. And even if it is, keep this in mind. I'm voting Gary Johnson, baby. If that's the way you want it, Hillary, then I don't want you around. I don't believe it, not for a minute. If they played fair, Bernie Sanders would have won. I'm living in a swing state with the governor LePage to hate, so I'm trying hard not to pretend. But I can feel it coming. Libertarians like Gary are running, and I'll never look back again. So if you vote for Gary, then I'll vote for Hillary. Then we won't have Trump around. You better believe it, I'm looking to trade it. So let's stop the bickering and have some fun and get this motherfucker done.
Yes, give me a reefer cake.
Good anti-weed song there.
You didn't even say anything about weed, did you?
No, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's implicit.
The thought process, though, also might be associated
maybe. I think there's something to the whole trade your vote
for
Gary Johnson that Jimmy is offering. So good for Jimmy. But, you know, one of the other songs I like that Jimmy Reefer Cake once wrote and sang went something like this.
Today is Casual Friday. Let us welcome Isabel Gillies to the show. She's going to recommend a movie or two to watch on Netflix. It's the only way I know. Listen to the picks from Isabel. IsabelGillies.com.
Yes, Jimmy Reefer Cake. Check him out at allthehypocrisy.com. I think if you just Google Jimmy Reefer Cake, you can find his music quite easily. I doubt there's two Jimmy Reefer Cakes out there, ladies and gentlemen. And there's only one Isabel Gillies, and we are so lucky to have her on the line. Hello, Isabel.
Hello.
Hello, hello.
How are you?
Me this lucky.
What's going on?
I'm good. I'm in deep.
Deep in the cozy book? For people who don't know, Isabel is writing a book on the concept, right? Is it the concept of coziness?
Yes. It is.
And what's
it's
what do
the
you
concept?
What do you do?
The,
what do you do when you investigate this?
Well, I just spoke with an ICU nurse in a neurological surgery unit.
What?
And yeah, I did. And I just went to Denmark.
Wait. So what did the ICU nurse tell you?
Well, because my thought about coziness is that it's not hot chocolate and Shirlene and cashmere and like fires and L.L. Bean. It's about something like the truth of who you are, figuring that out. It's more like, you know, the feeling when you put a puzzle piece into it, the thing that fits, and it's like this, tap, and you're like, ah, oh, and there's this little like feeling of like, yes.
Accomplishment.
That.
No, or that everything makes sense.
Yeah, everything makes sense. It's like one thing fitting into another. You feel good. It's that. So voting is cozy. Riding the number one train is cozy. It's not.
What?
It's.
What do you
yeah,
do? Wait, wait,
oh,
wait,
yeah.
wait, 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 wait. The number one train?
Yeah.
Why is that? Because it's a local train. And is that it? Is it because
a,
it's a local train?
It's local. Good,
right.
Good observation. A, it's local. So
now, let me just explain this. Let me just explain this to people who don't live in New York, who don't live in a city where there's subways, because I don't know if people there's basically two types of trains that you can take on any given track. Generally, one is the
Correct.
Express, which will stop every like third or fourth or fifth stop. And, you know, people that transports people. You know, in an express, it transports a lot more people, a lot longer distance. And then you have the local. And the one is a local train that goes from the bottom of Manhattan all the way
to the top.
To the top.
And it's just a real workhorse. It's just ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum. And you get on that train, you know where you're going. If you have a scarf and a long magazine article and a corner seat, you get on there, you see all of humanity, because that's on the subway, you're really seeing the cross section. You're seeing everybody. And it in some very real way, it's like when you're in some sort of contact sharing this space with like a smattering of people, you're like, okay, here we are. We're all together. There's this real feeling of togetherness. And then you get if you get a corner seat, then you're really sort of, you know, you're moored. And then you know where that thing's going. You can read your magazine article, like one of those 9,000 word, you know, New Yorker pieces about a python or something, or like air traffic control or something, you know, one of those real ones that takes a long time to read, but you're glad you did it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's cozy. It's just as cozy to me. And so, you know, my whole thing about, you know, life is
Isabel,
rough,
wait
right?
a second. Wait a second. Can I ask you this? Did you meet this ICU nurse because of this, this trauma that you had about the train, or what's going on here? What's it? Because
what?
I don't, none of this make the, I don't, when I go on the one train, I just think that, oh God, I can't wait to get off.
See, but Sam.
What?
You got to go on it, right? So it's like one time I was waitressing and this co-worker of mine said, oh my God, I can't believe we're going to be here for 8 hours. And I was like, what? I was so young. I was like, wait a minute. If you're bummed out that you are going to be here for 8 hours, so either turn your frown upside down or get another job, because you got to be, I loved waitressing. I was like, this is kind of awesome. We're going to, you know, you get some like free food sometimes, you're always in contact with people. It was like we were a little community. You knew the chefs and everybody, and it was just so fun. And I was like, if you don't think this is fun, I don't know why you'd spend 8 hours here. You know, I don't understand that. So
they probably did it for the cash. I mean,
right, but there's a lot of, she was young, like, go do something else then, you know? Figure it out. Or
those
figure
pro
out
bono
a way.
Waitresses.
My,
really...
bigger theory.
Yeah.
Is that you figure out a way to make what you're doing like cozy or enjoyable or meaningful. You know, we're constantly doing things we don't want to do. You could end up in a hospital. That's why I talked to the ICU nurse, and you probably will end up in a hospital at one point. And if you know yourself and you know what makes you feel good, like let's say you know you like birds, right? And you know that about yourself. Maybe your hospital bed has a window in it, and maybe a bird perches on the thing. And you could be like, you know what? I'm going to focus on that, and that will ground you in something that you like. And then then the experience you're having, which is probably not so great if you're in a hospital, unless you're having a baby, and that even is hard, will be better. And that's making yourself feel cozy. So.
What if the bird doesn't show up on the windowsill? I mean, I haven't seen. It's not like we got a windowsill here at the office, and we've been here for 2.5 years. I never seen a bird land on that windowsill.
Well, maybe do you care though? Maybe you don't. Maybe you don't even care about birds.
Well, but my point is, if I did care, how am I going to get a bird on the windowsill? So then you got to go out and get a bird seed, and you got to put it on the windowsill.
I'm just saying, let's say you're in your. Actually, I find radio and all that, you know, when you have to be, like, recording stuff, very cozy because it's quiet and you're all in a little community. You're talking. I mean, I find what you do, I love coming into the office because it's cozy.
Well, you're not the first person to say that today, even.
What?
I will say, though, that I would, if I was in the hospital for an extended stay, and knock on wood, I've never had to be in the hospital for an extended stay. Just the ability to listen to 16 hours a day of right-wing talk radio, I think I would really enjoy.
Well, you might.
I know. I do. I love that.
Well, radio's there. There's a whole chapter in my book.
I would just spend
radio.
The whole time calling in is basically what I would do. It's keep it on hold. I'd see if I could get multiple phone lines, and I would just be on hold on 3 different shows.
Oh, God.
Nurse,
you know,
nurse, I need another phone.
Yes. Another? Can I just tell you that another?
Please bring
woman
the catheter because
I
can't leave. I'm on hold on 3 different
about
shows.
About to nail
really,
him on the
Kelly,
Medicare Trust
happening?
Fund.
What?
Am I hearing myself? Am I breaking up?
No, we hear you. What's going on? What did you do? What did you do? You didn't like me talking about that?
I just couldn't hear it. I couldn't hear.
Oh, you couldn't hear? All right, so okay, so you talked to the ICU nurse about how other people make themselves cozy, not like
or how she makes people cozy too.
Okay. Are they allowed to bring their dog?
In the
I don't know.
Hospital?
Not in the
sometimes
ICU,
dogs
probably.
Are allowed in hospitals, Sam.
Yes, those are called veterinary hospitals.
No,
those are called help dogs, but I don't think in the ICU is
ICU doesn't sound like where you could have
it's not appropriate
well,
to
I
have
hope
an
I
animal
don't go there.
In a place like that. So, well, okay, so what were you doing in Sweden?
I was in Denmark because they have a whole word that means cozy called hygge.
What?
H-Y-G-G-E, hygge.
Okay, so what is hygge?
It means coziness.
All right, but... Well, so doesn't coziness. So, I mean,
yeah,
what...
Yeah, but they have a whole... You know how umami... Haven't we already discussed it? You know umami is the sixth taste. It means like a lot of things.
Oh,
you know,
right. Earthy taste,
a lot
right.
Of
we
things?
Did talk about this, but I don't...
Yeah. So I went to Denmark last week.
Oh, all right. Well, then we didn't talk about the actual trip.
No, I went to Denmark, and I went to London because London is cozy, and I went to the Tower of London.
Wait, where's not cozy? I mean, the one train, London, Denmark.
Here's the thing. I won't put in the book anything that's not cozy.
Well,
because what is cozy to one person might not be cozy to another.
It's starting to sound like a scam to me. I mean, it's
a
like...
scam?
Well, a little bit. I mean...
Genteel Scientology.
Whoa. That's going to be the subtitle.
That is like...
No, I mean,
so
wait a second. No, don't... no, don't stay in your... Yeah, Michael.
I'm kidding.
What is wrong with you?
I'm just creating some coziness for myself, Isabel.
Singing my song. I'm a little bit bummed out about everything that's going on.
Why?
I've been watching Barack. I've been watching Michelle all morning.
Yeah? Why are you bummed? Things are...
Well, I know.
Yeah, I mean, I know how much Trump was your hero and your idol. And it's tough to get past.
You can't even make that joke anymore.
You feel cozy, Isabel?
Oh, God.
That
is
disturbing.
This is turning out not so fun for me.
Oh, Michael, now you be quiet.
Okay.
Just cut his mic.
You're calling me a Scientologist?
No, it was a joke.
And a...
Sorry.
We just Michael is just
let's create some coziness.
Put Michael's microphone down. He's in the corner for
turn
a little.
Turn your microphone off.
Okay, so wait
That's
a second.
What Ben Carson told a woman on Morning Joe. This
I
morning.
Know we've got that.
Can't you turn the microphone off?
It's What's insane, the matter with everybody? Isn't it? It's insane. So wait a second. So you're in London. What did you what was cozy in London? Tea, right?
The
tea.
Tower of London. If you really want to know.
Wow, how is the Tower of London cozy?
I'll tell you why. Because I was dyslexic. I am dyslexic. So when I was growing up, what I needed to learn was very heavy plot. I really loved a story, right? And then that would anchor me in whatever. So in history, when the Tudors came up, I was suddenly like, what? This guy changed the whole religion so he could get married, blah, blah. And I just grasped onto it and got into it. And then also Hamlet. And so then I'd never been to the Tower of London and I always wanted to go. And I wanted to see where Anne Boleyn came up the Thames and came in. And so I was so excited to go. And the jewels are there.
The what?
The crown jewels of England are there. And you can see them and you can see all the stories of how they got there. And sometimes they're on loan. Because some queen is wearing one. It's incredibly cozy. And I met my friend who also never had been there, and we just went to the Tower of London, and then we got the Acousta Guide, which is, Acousta Guides are probably the most cozy thing in the whole world.
So wait, now, it sounds like coziness is something when things make sense, I guess.
Yes.
I see. And so it's comfortability. It's a lack of tension.
It's communication. It's just where how you feel good.
And
but
so,
a lot of people don't know how to make themselves feel good.
All right, now
and they can
I'm
be in a
understand.
Place that they think, oh, this is obviously a bad situation. But I think if I could be so bold, I think that there's always a way that you can figure it out how to get yourself out of it. And a lot of that is knowing about what you like. And it can be small stuff. Like holding a rock can sometimes make you feel really cozy.
Now, so when you go to Denmark, you go to the Heineken plant and you get cozy.
No, I didn't go there. But boy, do they drink in Denmark. Woo!
So, all right. So you got really drunk in Denmark. And
I didn't. I couldn't even get drunk. You know why? Because I can't really drink anymore. It's so sad and middle-aged. I felt like a real middle-aged nerd there.
So wait a second. So what were you doing? Why Denmark? Just because they have a name for cozy? I mean, other places have a name for cozy, don't they, or no?
Not as in such a big way. Maybe I'm in the middle of researching this.
Okay, so what did you find in Denmark that was so huge?
You know what they didn't really have. You know what I did? What was interesting? If we're going to be political today, which is what I feel like being,
okay.
I'm a little on fire, is that they didn't seem to have a very big curiosity about America. And in England, they did. Everyone in England was like, what's happening with your whole thing over there? And actually, someone said, couldn't you just power, you know how when your iPhone doesn't work and you have
reset.
To power it all off and then power it back on?
Yeah.
Someone was like, shouldn't America just power down?
Well, that's, I think that's an impetus for a lot of the Trump voters. We just want to... maybe not a lot of the Trump voters, but some. I mean, certainly, I think some on the left who are not as concerned about a Trump win, the idea is that, we're just going to hit the reset button.
Right. That's right.
Yeah, except for it doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't work that way
with your phone, but it doesn't work that way with actual, human beings and political systems. Something else comes up. It doesn't just start over with a clean, fresh slate. Somebody's already got the pole position. So they're not interested in what's going on in America. Well, good for them.
I did not feel that's a huge sweeping generalization. I felt that there was a self-containment that I didn't feel in England. So they're sort of we're good. We have our programs and we're educated and we're all fine. We're not really, we got it. We don't really need the outside world. That, now, that's just what I felt. I'm not saying that they're like that. I'm just saying that it kind of felt like that to me. Everyone's so helpful, friendly, speak beautiful English, like beautiful English, and then beautiful Danish and probably six other languages. And it was wonderful. I just didn't feel this like they were like, where, you know, I don't even think people, if they found out where I was from, there was no follow-up question of like, whoa, what's going on? Like, what's, you know, it was sort of, there's sort of a bubble feeling I felt.
And
which isn't so bad. It's just, that's what it felt like.
Right. Which is like what America is, right? Like, I mean, if somebody from Denmark came here, the last question I can imagine anybody saying, like, what's going on with the Danish political situation? It's crazy over there.
I know. I know. Well, they actually have some, like a refugee thing happening over there.
True. So was there any coziness that you found there, or was that, or is
I totally found so much coziness. There's open-faced sandwiches. There's this rye bread that I'm about to make for my book. It takes 5 days.
5 days to make bread? Doesn't seem worth it.
Doesn't seem worth it?
No, it seems like a long time to make bread. I mean,
well, what do you think everyone's doing all over the place that makes bread? It takes a long time.
Well, it doesn't take 5 days to make your average piece of bread. You just you make the dough and then you put it in the oven.
Wrong. You are wrong, sir. It is not just a make the dough, put it in the oven situation. There's rising. You got to make your starter, your sourdough starter.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it just seems that's a lot of, like, how long is it going to take you to eat the bread? You know, like a half an hour, and then you spend 5 days.
Sam, I thought you were really into sandwiches, though. And 5 day bread, it sounds like make a great sandwich.
I'll leave
my
bread
out
for 5 days.
And
how's
it
that
would.
Sound?
And also, I made, I was so upset yesterday because of all the Trump stuff that I made a cauliflower soup, and I even made my own stock with just a parmesan rind.
What are you talking about? That sounds good, though, the cauliflower soup.
It was delicious.
Sorry. So, how do you make the cauliflower soup? Let's hear this.
Well, I made a stock with onions and garlic and olive oil and browned them up. And then I put put some wine in there, scraped up all the brown stuff. And then I put some rosemary in and some frozen, whenever I finish parmesan, I take the rinds and freeze them. So I put those in there and put 8 cups of water and then let it boil for 2 hours.
Wow. Sounds pretty good.
And it was this delicious stock. And then I put it in, I sauteed up some cauliflower, 2 big heads of it, and then put it in the stock and then let it boil and then let it get tender. And then I whizzy-whacked up the whole thing.
Here we go. This is the cooking segment that we have. Isabel Gillis.
Yeah, cauliflower soup's so good in the fall.
Yeah, it sounds good. So what else? I mean, are the kids freaking out about Trump or what?
Yes. Well, yes. And they have to watch the debate for homework.
Ooh.
And so, yeah, they do. Well, you know, he's in high school.
Wow.
So they have to watch the debate for high school. And now it's like, pussy this. It's all, the whole thing has come off. Everything, we're talking about everything and it's fine. And I heard someone yesterday talking on the radio about the woman who wrote that meme about, like, I'm going to get you pussy or something like that. And she said, and I agree with her, that this is good because it's the discussion, we're having a discussion and it's, you know, talking about these issues that must be discussed.
Right.
And, you know, so in our home, we are having all these discussions. It's just sad to me because it's really... I don't know. It's sort of it's not sad to me. I guess it's sort of confusing to me.
In what way?
Like, well,
like, how did we get here?
I guess how do we get there? I mean, I sort of know how we get there, but wouldn't it, if let's say no matter what the who the two candidates were, the kids' homework, the 14-year-old's homework would be to watch the debate. So if we weren't talking about what we're talking about with Trump, we'd probably be talking about more substantive issues, right? And then so
it would
be like,
I would imagine.
How are we going to deal with relationships with other countries or with climate change or with these things that then these young minds.
What does it mean to block grant Medicaid payments?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, they would be talking about health care and all these things instead of, you know, predatory behavior, which they should be talking about predatory behavior, but maybe that should be not the only thing we're talking about when you have these big teaching moments, which elections are. Elections are big, huge teaching moments.
We have a generation of kids who are just going to learn from politics that it's inappropriate to say that you're going to grab someone's pussy.
Well, arguably, exactly. That is more important because it's so widespread. Not, I mean, not that specific problem, but sexism and just, I mean, as I was going through the video clips, which were all about new accusations toward Trump yesterday, I got really, really upset, you know, and it hadn't upset me during the show. And then watching them again, I was like, this is insane. Like, yeah. how many things are coming out. And the really upsetting part was, you know, this isn't all that abnormal. Like, I'm getting upset because his entitlement makes me angry and all of this, but this stuff happens regularly to
all
women.
The time. Yeah. And I have recounted in my own mind and to my husband, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 times that I've been in situations that I did not like the way I was being treated by men in like a fraternity once at Brown and just like in, you know, during my whole late teens and 20s that I buried and it all came up. And it is true that, that I think women all over and maybe some men are sort of reliving all these. And it
yeah,
does
absolutely.
Need to be a discuss.
That's what it felt like. That's what it felt like. It felt like I was being, you know, and I always hate to say this, but being triggered because I was thinking about stuff that I don't really think about, and it just made me angry and then upset
and sad. Right, I feel sad right now because I'm remembering this terrible time in this fraternity, and I the whole time was thinking, what am I doing? I must be doing something wrong. I can't. I have to get out of here, but I can't because everybody is sort of surrounding me. It was like, it's really, really horrible. And the whole thing I blamed on myself. The whole thing. I should never have been there. I don't know what have I done to incite these people? And by the way, I mean, and I'm about to say, like, I wasn't doing anything. Like, I was like maybe 18, 17 or 18. Ugh.
It's much more difficult to navigate that type of stuff when you are in a workplace, which you mentioned working in a restaurant, but in like an office setting where maybe it's not overtly sexual stuff, which sometimes it is, but when there's sexism happening and plenty of women all across the country and the world can
just
relate directly to that. Yeah. And you
yeah.
just remember,
oh, yeah.
And you're like, what do I do?
A theater company? It was just as bad as anything. It really, really was in this sort of artistic thing. And there was just sexism and stuff like that. And there was, I'm now remembering, someone spoke to me in the restaurant that I was working in a way that he got kicked out of the restaurant because I talked to my boss about it.
Yeah, that's happened to me. Yeah. And it makes things really confusing overall to navigate, because then once you get to a certain level of enough things having happened to you, you're questioning motives of what, why people are saying this and how you're being treated, and you have to, you know, like, position yourself in professional situations or, you know, personal situations. And it's just, I don't know, it's a lot.
Is a lot. And when you're raising, the thing that's upsetting also is that when you're raising especially boys, I feel that I've done a sufficient job, I hope, before this whole discussion happened, of saying, look, you can't treat people, you have to treat everyone with kindness and dignity and respect. And when you're, you know, they're all going through puberty, so when you are feeling all these feelings, you have to make sure that, you know, I feel like I'm trying to teach them that. And so must every parent. But then it doesn't, you know, I knew Billy Bush when I was growing up. You know, I know his parents. They're nice people. I'm sure everyone's thinking that they're doing a good job. No one is saying to their parents, or I can't imagine, you know, go and like, touch someone's pussy when they don't ask. That's a good thing to do. Like, no one's saying that. So how is it true that that's happening so much? How is it true that it's a problem?
Well, God knows, honestly, what was going on in the Trump household. I'll say that. I mean, honestly, like, you know,
that's true.
There is... you know, you can't make any type of diagnosis, but there was definitely some major form of abuse or something that was going on in that household, or maybe
or
it was
neglect.
Drunk, something that got really, there is some very dark crap that I have a feeling went down there. But
you know what I mean? No one's raising their kids. You don't purposefully raise your kids
but
to
I
be
don't,
anything, but.
But I think there
respectful.
Are people. Well, but wait a second.
No, there are
but
people that,
there
that
are people
absolutely raise
who,
their kids
who
to be
set
disrespectful.
A value. They don't necessarily set out to raise their kids this way, but their set of values is such that, you know, we look upon people as commodities. And we also have a sort of an unspoken notion of hierarchy amongst those commodities. And so when you see an attractive woman, they, you know, that's just it's just like a cool TV set that you can get, and you know, you can treat it as if it's a commodity in that way.
Right.
I mean, there's no, I don't think, and probably, you know, I don't know Billy Bush's dad, you probably met him, but, you know, God knows what he was saying when he and Billy were hanging out together. Like, you know, walking down the street, like, take out those legs. I mean, it definitely had that dynamic of right. Billy Bush thought he was like with his dad, and Donald Trump thought like, oh, look, I've got a little sycophant here. And they're both sort of feeding into this weird, creepy relationship.
It's like this entitled bro culture. That's what it is. It's entitled bro culture. It's like all these guys that are well brought up or like, well, they've benefited from the best quote unquote education and the most privilege and the all and they should know better. They should know better, and they should be more generous, and they should be more protective, and they should be more intelligent about the way that they treat their fellow humans. And they're not. It's this entitled bro culture of like, I sort of have heard it my whole life, but I kind of, I don't know if I ignored it or if I just went along or like, I don't know. It's sort of boorish. Ugh, so
you know,
well, Sam,
Billy Bush
Sam
is,
just called,
Billy,
you just called it weird. And I just want to say that it's not abnormal. This
right.
type of banter between Trump and Bush, that it was extreme.
I think the dynamic
banter,
between,
but it's not abnormal.
What I think the dynamic between those two guys was weird in the sense that, like, Billy Bush, this was not like two guys who perceived themselves as equals in some way. I mean, there was
no.
a quality of that dynamic that was not just two guys sitting there, you know, saying those things back and forth and encouraging it. You know, Billy Bush was trying to, like, impress him. And here's the thing. Why I don't feel sympathy for this guy whose career is now, you know, in the crapper. And we haven't talked that much about Billy Bush beyond the first video because, you know, whatever. He's not relevant, at least in terms of politics here. But and apparently, like, he's lawyering up to get NBC, I don't know what, to probably just get a better deal from NBC. But here's a guy who, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I suspect it's not like if he doesn't have this job in television that he's going to be, you know, his family's going to be in financial jeopardy. And if you got to be in a job where you feel like you got to do this to get ahead, and I'm just giving him probably way too much benefit of doubt, but I'm just like saying, like, even like why I don't even hesitate for a moment to cast his actions in his harshest light possible. Like, you know, everybody has to weigh out, what am I willing to do at work based upon what, how financially precarious am I? You know, I don't, I don't judge people who are in a, you know, people call and they say, I've been out of work for 6 months and, you know, should I take a job here at this, I don't know, whatever this operation is. And I don't like, you know, the work they do. And I think that, like, you know, you gotta make sure that you're able, you know, you live in this society and, you know, making that decision is, it seems to me, you got to weigh, you know, the sort of the financial considerations. But here's a guy who, like, there's no excuse. He's 35 years old, 34 years old when he's doing this stuff. And it's not like if he loses his job on Access Hollywood because he wouldn't kiss Donald Trump's, he didn't have any other place to go. And so I don't know. I mean, I just
But
think,
you know what? Here's what I'd like. Here's what I'd say to my children. I'd say, and I've said some form of it, but not to this. But, like, let's say on that tape we heard Billy Bush say, you know what, Donald, I'm sorry, but that talk is I don't like that. It's making me uncomfortable. It's not, I don't like that you're talking about my coworker, that you know, my colleague like that. And I really wish you'd stop. You know, that we would be discussing him as a hero. We would say there is a gentleman who is doing the right thing, and that's we should you know, look up to that, kids. That's the way you behave. But can you think of someone doing that? Like, of all your friends,
I mean, like, I would tell this story about this guy from Air American. I just sort of looked at him cross-eyed, and I think I just, you know, like, I don't get what you're saying. I don't expect Billy Bush to be a hero in that situation. But Billy Bush wasn't.
I wish he would have been.
Of course. That would have been great. But he didn't. There's a middle ground here, and he went the opposite direction. Like, when they get off that bus, and his first thing is like, give Donald a hug. Like him saying, like, look at me, I can deliver the goods for you, man. And then I'm gonna get my taste too. Like, it was just, that was just the creepiest, and his cackling. Like, you know, if you're in the bus and Donald Trump is talking this way, and you can just. Right. Well, yeah. I mean, I don't think it's incumbent upon every single person in those contexts to get into somebody's face. I understand he's got a job to do, and, you know, Donald Trump is Donald Trump, and the tape is there if they want to release that, whatnot. I mean,
but the message to the kids is, when this is all happening, because it's happening in front of their face every day, is to say, actually, guys, don't just stand there. This is now, the game has changed, right? So now it's in the discussion. It's in, the whole nation is talking about this. So it's incumbent upon you, if you hear someone talking about a friend of yours or someone you're working with or someone in your class or your roommate in a way that you don't like and you don't feel comfortable because you know better, you stand up and you say, that makes me feel uncomfortable. Stop talking like that.
Well,
and that's what we have to, that's the lesson now. That
Here's the differential, is that to expect your son to say it to his coach, I think is too much. To say it to his peer is another thing. And the theory is that by the time your son's peer gets to be a coach, he's already learned that lesson. Like, you know, I mean, and that's why it's so much more egregious when a boss does these type of things, because they're in a coerced relationship on some level. Where, you know, people who are not the boss, who are an employee, feel that it's more precarious for them to do that. And I don't hold anybody, you know, I don't have the expectations that someone would say that to their boss, or I don't you know, fault anybody for not saying that in that situation, because it's a precarious situation to be in. But, you know, in a peer situation, you know, definitely you say that. I mean, it's, you know, I think it's, it would be great if people had that ability to do that. And certainly that's why I'm saying, like, a guy like Billy Bush, you know, his financial situation maybe not be, and I'm projecting, I have no idea, but I'm guessing that he's not in as precarious of a situation where he didn't have to, at the very least, like, here, I'm going to deliver you. Look at what I did for you, Donald. I got her to hug you. Like, that was just the creepiest thing I would imagine. But so what should we, what do you have to recommend us to watch? The Anita Hill hearings?
I guess what I'm going to recommend is something I've already recommended, but it's the next season. I'm having that thing that I can hear myself.
You can hear, you can hear. I don't know what.
No, I can't.
Okay.
So I'm going to recommend this, the third season of Transparent.
I have to admit, I have not seen the first or second seasons.
Oh, you haven't?
No.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. And I will say that it's very purposeful why I'm recommending it this week, because not only did I just finish the third season, and you can stream it, but they do talk about and raise issues about the things that we should be talking about. Like, when all of this stuff about inequality and women and gender and all that stuff is being batted around on a daily basis, watch this to sort of as a balancing, because these are good. I can hear myself. I've got to get to a different part of my house.
Oh, sorry.
I can hear myself. It's just a smart, intelligent, human show. They're 22 minutes each. The acting is so good, and it's funny, and it's very Jewish. It's just about a family, and it's you know, the father is trans, and so it's all, you know, transparent, right? So it's all about those issues, but it's also about the coming of age. See, transparent.
Honestly,
have you
not seen it?
Has no one seen it?
No, well, I knew Jeffrey Tambor plays a trans woman, but I never got the whole part about parent.
It's
no,
father.
I'm serious.
Yeah,
I didn't know. I mean, I didn't know. You know, my problem is I don't think I can watch comedies anymore. I haven't watched a comedy in ages.
No, but it's a dramedy. It's not a 22 minute ba-dum-bum at all. It's beautiful, Sam. It's beautiful. Jill Soloway is just.
No, I'm a fan of hers.
Well, she's the mastermind, and it's. It's especially, I think it's, I've never seen a Jewish family portrayed in such a sort of, it feels very real to me, and very,
Jewy.
It's deep, it's kind of Jewy, it's talking about the issues that I think we need to talk about more, and get comfortable with. I guess I'm going to sound sort of corny, but I really just think we have to get this election. What I say to the children, I was like, you know, and it's not, I'm the only one to say it, but whatever happens, whoever wins, like, it is clear that whatever you guys are choosing to do in your life, whether that's like be a dancer or a doctor or a scientist, you have to put those efforts to addressing what just happened. Like, if it's, you're going to go figure out the refugee situation and try and help there, if you're going to try and work for, you know, Planned Parenthood, if you're a doctor, work. I mean, it is clear that the country needs help, and they're the generation that are going to be able to apply their skills to these problems. And so the conversations have to shift, and muscle has to be put behind, you know, fighting a good fight. And I think, so that's why I'm recommending Transparent, because I feel like they're talking about the right things.
All right. There you have it, folks.
Okay.
Transparent.
I just got a little tearful.
I know. Thanks. Wow. That was very...
Well, I'm upset today. Everybody's upset. And I don't, you know.
Well, don't worry. It's all going to be over in 4 weeks, unless it's not. And then it's just going to be horrific for years. But he's going to lose.
But when we turned over the rock, we saw everything that was going wrong in there.
Well, I mean, if it makes you feel any better, I've been looking at that for 10 years. Why do you think I'm? So
I know you
sour
have.
Puss?
You have.
Such a sour.
I was a little with Obama. I got a little bit like, yay, it's all good now.
Nope. Not all good.
Not all good.
Getting better, but just very, very slowly.
Slower than you thought, right?
No. Isabel Gillies, always a pleasure. Mila's going to give you a call because she's Red Starry Night.
Oh,
she loves it.
I love it. Was it too racy?
Well, I mean, she didn't. No, of course it was. I said to her, like, was this too racist? No. What? Dad.
No, it's very nerdy. It's a little nerdy.
No. She's excited to talk to you about it.
I'll come to her school and talk.
Oh, maybe she would like that. I don't
know. That's what I do. I come and I bring a transcript. Like, I bring a big manuscript with the editor's notes, and there's like all so many, you know, red pencil circling things and so many mistakes. And so I show it to them. I'm like, look, if you've ever gotten, you know, red marks on your papers for having mistakes, it never ends, but it's okay. And they pass it all around and love it. And then I talk about love and falling in love when you're a teenager. It's fun.
Oh, awesome. All right. Well, I'll talk
to
her about
come
that.
To school.
Maybe she'll arrange that. Isabel Gillies, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much, Izzy.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
I'll be listening. Bye. Bye.
All right, folks. Head into the fun half for a little bit.
Yeah, it's time to go to the fun half.
All right, folks, we got a lot of sound to go through. And don't forget, you can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Pennies a day. Your support keeps the show alive. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Give us a review on YouTube. On iTunes. Not on YouTube. I don't know. I'm tired. Now I'm upset.
Give us a comment on YouTube, please.
What are you doing?
All right. Take a quick break. We'll be right back with the fun half.